This is a CBC podcast. Explore the people and ideas behind theoretical physicist Neil Turok's The Universe Within and immerse yourself in the Massey experience. Go to cbc.ca/masseys for contests, live chats, and everything between the Big Bang and the God Particle.
Hello, I'm Carol Off.
Good evening, I'm Jeff Douglas, and this is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight
is the party over? After the resignation of Dalton McGuinty, we'll speak with one of the two Liberal premiers still standing, Prince Edward Island's Robert Giz.
Goodbye, Queen's Park. Hello, House of Commons. Ontario Liberal strategist Warren Kinsella talks about the possible federal aspirations of the soon-to-be former Ontario premier.
They're anonymous, but he isn't. The hacker group claims it's found the man who was blackmailing a teenager who committed suicide. He publishes his name.
FYI, for your intimidation, in the swing state of Ohio, new billboards target voter fraud. But some say the ads are actually targeting certain voters.
A sprinkling of doubt. Environmentalists are horrified by a geoengineering project involving 100 tons of iron sulfate powder being deposited in the Pacific. But the man responsible says it's already working wonders.
And sense and nonsense. For the new Chanel No. 5 commercial starring Brad Pitt to seem at all coherent, it is possible you have to drink a bottle of this stuff. As it happens, the podcast edition. Radio. Unicorns. The future. If you want to be the leader of a Liberal Party in Canada, your chances have likely never been better. With the resignation of Ontario Premier Dalton McGuinty yesterday, the Liberals are currently looking for leaders in six provinces, as well as federally. The Liberal parties of Ontario, Quebec, Manitoba, New Brunswick, Saskatchewan, and Newfoundland and Labrador are all leaderless. And British Columbia Premier Christy Clark is currently fighting to survive a provincial election next May, which leaves one last Liberal leader standing on solid ground. Robert Giz is the Premier of Prince Edward Island. We reached him in Charlottetown.
Mr. Giz, how does it feel to be holding down the Liberal fort?
Well, I think that, across the country, we're going through a lot of political change right now, and political parties go up and down, and in Prince Edward Island, I guess I'm still fortunate that we've got a strong Liberal majority government here, but, for the time being, I think that we'll see Liberal parties across the country rebuilding, similar to how different parties have rebuilt over the past themselves.
Well, it's definitely a half-full scenario of the glass. I mean, there's Christy Clark and her Liberals in British Columbia, but they're hanging on by a thread, and it really comes down to you, doesn't it?
Well, I guess from that perspective, I've been a Liberal my entire life, worked in Ottawa. But when I came back to Prince Edward Island, we were a party that was 30 points behind in the polls. We had one seat in the provincial legislature. We had a huge debt as a party. And 5 years later, things turned around. So, I think the same thing will happen in a lot of different areas as well. But it takes time, and there's nothing wrong with renewal.
Now, I know that you and Dalton McGuinty have a lot in common, not just your love of potatoes. I saw you brought potatoes to him when you visited him once.
Yeah. That was a gift in light of my sister marrying his son.
Right. And is it traditional for you to bring potatoes when that happens?
Well, it's probably a first, I'm pretty proud of our PEI potatoes.
Now, what do you make of Premier McGuinty's resignation?
Well, first of all, I just want to congratulate him on a great career of public service to the people of Ontario and even to the people of Canada. Ontario is a leader within Canada and plays a huge role within our country. And I know Dalton rebuilt the Liberal Party there that had been out of power for a while, since the David Peterson days. And a lot of people at the beginning said that he'd never become premier. And I think he became probably one of the most successful, politically speaking, Liberal premiers in the province's history. And like any politician, you know, there's always time to sit back, reflect, and perhaps take that walk in the snow and say that it's time to move on. And Dalton's decided to do that. And from my opinion, he'll be a big loss to our Council of the Federation.
You mentioned 2003 when Dalton McGuinty's Liberals took over in Ontario. But at that time, you had not just a strong majority of Liberals in Ontario. You had a strong majority in the province of Quebec. You had the nation's capital. You had the Liberals under Paul Martin. There were the strong Liberals across the country, including yourself. What's happened to the brand?
Well, the brand is... sometimes in politics, things go cyclical. And you look back prior to 2003, before you saw Dalton McGuinty, before you saw Jean Charest, before you saw, well, a few years before that, before you saw Liberals in BC, there was no Liberals here in Prince Edward Island. We had one seat. And then you saw it turn. And we were able to make some great investments. Similar to how you saw the Progressive Conservatives that had, I think, one of the largest majorities after the 1988 federal election. And then come 1993, they reduced down to two seats. And I remember everyone writing off their party for years to come. And then now everyone says that Stephen Harper could be there for a while. So when it comes to these things, you know, politics is a profession that is very rewarding, but at the same time is extremely difficult. And, you know, I think most of us politicians that go into it know that. We try to do the best we can. We try to be thick-skinned, you try to make decisions that you think are going to be good for today, but also into the future. And any dealings that I've had with Dalton McGuinty, he's always put the interests of Ontarians first.
I guess if you're a Liberal, there are a lot of job opportunities then, aren't there? I mean, there's, what, seven different Liberal leader jobs available in Canada right now, including the leader of the federal Liberals. So, I mean, are those leaders there? Do they exist?
You know, I think that you'll always see people rise to the occasion for public service, and you'll see a rebound at some point of Liberal parties in different jurisdictions. But it's important to point out, I think in Ontario, they still are in government. Yes, they're going through difficult issues, but, you know, you never know what may happen. And perhaps the political landscape's changing a little bit. You look at Quebec today, where there's governments being elected with low 30% of the vote. Federally, you see a divided electorate out there as well. And people are having more choices today. So I think that people will be inspired and hopefully we'll see some strong Liberals come to the forefront.
Now, would you encourage Dalton McGuinty to enter the federal Liberal leader race?
From my personal perspective, I think Dalton McGuinty would make a fantastic Prime Minister. Now, if you spoke to perhaps his family, they may think that after 16 years in public life, it's time to take a break. But, you know, that's a decision that Dalton will have to weigh himself. But I can say that, you know, I've looked up to Dalton McGuinty. I've looked up to Jean Charest. You know, there's a lot of good politicians out there, a lot of them are relatively young. Of course, they're not as young as myself, but they're relatively young.
Oh, you mentioned yourself. You want to venture something there?
No, I'm just pointing out that it's quite amazing today that I will be pretty soon the longest-serving premier in the country, but also the youngest premier in the country all at the same time.
And the only Liberal. Premier Giz, good to talk to you. Thanks.
Okay, bye. Thank you very much.
Robert Giz is the Premier of Prince Edward Island. He was in Charlottetown. And in case you were wondering, Premier Giz is the ripe old age of 38. Warren Kinsella is a veteran McGuinty supporter. We reached the longtime Liberal strategist in Toronto.
Mr. Kinsella, what do you make of the timing of Dalton McGuinty's resignation?
I reacted to it with sadness and some disappointment because I've had the privilege to volunteer for him and on his various campaigns for more than a decade. So I'm sad to see him go, but I'm optimistic about what the future may hold.
We just heard from Premier Robert Giz in Prince Edward Island, who said that he thinks that Dalton McGuinty would make a very fine prime minister. Do you think that's what's behind this?
I agree with that a great deal. But do I think that's what is behind that? I don't think so. You know, politicians, and you've interviewed many over the years, are always citing family and those types of concerns as the reason for making a change or removing themselves from politics. But this is actually a case where it would be the case with this guy. He is very preoccupied with his family. They're an important part of his life. His wife and his brother, just to cite one example, are probably his most senior and important advisors. So when he says family is part of it, he means it. But, you know, as in all things in politics, it's never one reason. It's all sorts of reasons.
But given the timing of it, this is, I mean, why now, if not to prepare himself for another career in politics?
I think the biggest reason is that I was with him on election night just slightly more than a year ago, and he was wildly optimistic about what minority government might bring. And he truly is a Democrat, and he truly believed that this was an opportunity to do some innovative things in governing. And I think he found out, to his disappointment, as did many others, that the opposition was much more preoccupied with gridlock and legislative games and so on. So, you know, perhaps he's now removed himself from the field. He said, look, if I'm the obstacle, I'll step back, and hopefully the business of the province can continue.
But come on, it's not just the opposition. I mean, he's got a contempt motion over costs of cancelling two gas plants. He's got a criminal investigation to the Orange Air Ambulance Service. And he's got a $14.5 billion deficit, the largest in the country. So don't you think that has something to do with his feeling, well, maybe I should just, like, look for the exit?
Well, on the very day that he made his announcement, you know, the deficit was again shown to have been reduced ahead of targets. The orange thing was conceived and managed principally by partisan conservatives. And the gas plant thing, I mean, if you distill it down to its base elements, what's it about? The opposition demanding more documents, saying that you're in contempt of the legislature and saying they're going to defeat you in a confidence motion. The last time that happened in Canadian history was in the spring of 2011, and the target was Stephen Harper, and he did rather well in the election that came afterward.
But is he leaving a big mess behind for his party, for his government to clean up?
No. You know, I've been in opposition, and, you know, you get up in the morning and you demand, you know, royal commissions and inquiries and, you know, scream that every sparrow that falls is a scandal. That's what you do in opposition, and, you know, that's what they're doing here. I understand their job. But is it meaningful with the public? No. And I think that that's why you see so many Liberals in particular and potential Liberal delegates saying to Dalton McGuinty, we would like you to consider this because we think you'd be a very capable and able candidate for the Liberal leadership.
You know, Liberals, not that they don't just criticize the policies of the Harper Conservative government, but they criticize the tactics, including some of the things that Stephen Harper's done, like prorogue Parliament. And then we see Dalton McGuinty shut down the legislature because he needs the Liberal Party to regroup. What do you make of that?
Federal Liberals may have done that, but, you know, I mean, no less an authority than the head of the National Citizens Coalition said last night that, you know, prorogation is a right and proper power and decision that can be made by a premier or a prime minister.
When it's used in the right context, when it's done because it's inconvenient to have the legislature run while you're trying to regroup, then it's not.
But my point is, this is precisely the instance where it is right and proper when you have literally legislative paralysis. I mean, the regrettable thing is there's been very little legislation passed in the Ontario legislature in the past year, precisely because the opposition have chosen to, you know, make it a forum for gridlock.
If a Liberal federal leadership race comes down to Justin Trudeau and Dalton McGuinty as the two leading candidates, what would Dalton McGuinty's pitch sound like?
I think he'd say, number one, I've got the biggest and most effective Liberal team, Liberal machine in the country. Number two, I've got experience in government, and some of the other candidates just don't. You know, that does count when you're up against a customer like Stephen Harper. And number three, I think, is that I've got a winning record, you know, with the exception of the last election where he fell one seat short of a majority. He very nearly, you know, equaled what Chrétien achieved, three back-to-back majorities. That ain't bad, and that's the kind of thing that Liberal delegates are preoccupied with.
And is the Dalton McGuinty machine oiled, fueled, and ready to go?
It's been oiled and fueled and ready to go for a decade, so we're ready to go. We just hope he's with us.
All right, just watch them.
That's right.
Mr. Kinsella, thank you.
Pleasure.
Warren Kinsella is an Ontario Liberal strategist. We reached him in Toronto. Some may say it sure doesn't sound like a good idea. Yesterday on the program, we told you about a controversial geoengineering project off the coast of Haida Gwaii in British Columbia. 100 tons of iron sulfate were dropped into the Pacific, the theory being that the resulting plankton boom may absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and attract salmon and other marine life to the area. Now, critics allege that the project contravenes international moratoria to dumping and geoengineering, to which Canada is a signatory. But the development corporation behind the project, which is funded by a village on Haida Gwaii, says the benefits are already apparent. John Disney is the president of the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation and the economic development officer for the Old Masset Village Council. We reached Mr. Disney in Old Masset, British Columbia.
Mr. Disney, what were you thinking would happen when you dumped 100 tons of iron sulfate into the Pacific?
We did a lot of study and preparation work for this, and we were almost sure we knew what would happen. Dumping's a bit of a misnomer, really. What we did is very carefully sprinkle on a very light dust of iron-rich dust onto the ocean, and from all our research and all our determinations and all our studies and talking to people all over the world in the marine science community, we were sure that we had nailed down the one thing the plankton in the Gulf of Alaska or North Pacific were missing, and that was iron. And that's what they needed. And we determined this, and we figured as soon as they got it, then they would go into bloom and everything would come with it. Because everything out there is starving because they're starving.
What has happened since you gave the plankton iron?
So once we've done this and the whole plankton biomass has come back to life, then everything in the ocean responded. So we had tuna moving in out of their area of comfort, like tuna fish, like warm water. They moved out of their comfort to where the food was, to where we were. We had salmon moving in. We had whales, dolphins. We had porpoises. We had everything moved in. We had birds like you wouldn't believe. We even had geese landing 300 miles off the west coast of Canada. We had brant geese landing. It's just that everything got attracted to where the food was because everything is starving out there.
You know that there is a lot of controversy around this kind of science, and there has been a reaction to the release that this is what you have done. There are people, scientists, environmentalists around the world have said that they're horrified, that this is a dubious and possibly destructive thing you've done. How do you respond to them?
Well, you know, that's very strange because we're talking to marine, like, I don't know who the people you're referring to are, but the people we're in contact with, you know, marine science organizations around the globe, everything from the Alfred Wegener Institute in Germany, we've got NOAA in the United States, we've got, you know, people all over, people in the Canary Islands, people who, this is their area of expertise, and they're all extremely excited before we did it, and now we've done it, because they've been waiting for a very long time for somebody to do this on a slightly larger scale than it's ever been done. This isn't the first off. This is probably the 13th or 14th experiment like this, but all the other ones are done on a smaller scale, maybe, you know, between 1 and 10 tons of dust. We've got people helping us from all over the world that are giving us free equipment and free advice and supporting us and giving us their knowledge. And the people I have working for me are an amazing bunch of people who are working for much reduced wages.
Can I ask you just about one of those people? This is Russ George, an American businessman. Is he he's someone you're working closely with on this project, yes?
Yeah, Russ George, like, I noticed in the sort of in your interviews with Mr. Thomas, they're portraying him completely wrong. He didn't come to us and sell us a bill of goods. We went to him. This is an old Masset community project. The corporation was just set up as the vehicle to handle all the business of running a complicated project like this. So we went to him because we have a relationship with Mr. George. We've done a lot of land-based stuff with him. He's never lied to us. He's never let us down. And he's not your average academic scientist working in a lab somewhere. He's the one that applies academic theories into practice.
Do you know that he is not, that you mentioned that he has, there have been experiments in the Canary Islands. Do you know that Russ George, his boats have been banned from the Canary Islands and the Galapagos?
Well, you know, okay, so you brought up the Planktos project now, and that was going to do in the Canary Islands. The trouble is the Planktos project, the problem with that I see it as an economic person, was never anything to do with the science or the plankton or putting iron in the water. The problem was with the structure of the company, because they wrestled with what we wrestled with, is you work out what you want to do, but then how do you get the money to do it? Because it's very hard. You can get investors, but then they always want to take control. Or you can do what they did. They went public, so they were on the stock exchange. But the trouble is that attracts all the wrong kind of people for the wrong reasons. So now suddenly the project became a potential money-making project and nothing to do with the science or the biology or fish. And so we went through all that. We talked to investors, we talked to banks, we talked to everybody, and in the end the community pulled back and said, you know what, this isn't going to work. So they decided, and this was a very long process of sort of 11 or 12 weeks of public meetings and then a closed ballot vote, the people of the community decided to put their money on the table to do this.
You mentioned that the interviews, we did one interview yesterday, a critic of your project, more than a critic, someone, an organization that believes that there should be swift legal action against you for doing doing this project. Did you have authorization? Did you have to seek out permits of any kind from any level of government?
I have three sets of lawyers watching our back on this. And I wasn't going to let anybody leave the dock until we had green lights. We've been in touch with the United Nations. You know, we're in conversations with them at Rio+20, and their ruling out of that is they've removed things like banning, and they've introduced words like precautionary approach. So the end result was, you know, it small scale ocean iron fertilization is their heading, comes under, is now permitted by the United Nations as long as you proceed with the precautionary approach. In other words, be very careful.
So you're saying this is not violating, as
no.
This is what Mr. Thomas and others have said, that you're in violation of several international resolutions that Canada has signed.
No, complete false.
And did you consult anyone with the federal government, with the Environment Department?
I've been in touch with 7 government departments, and I've met twice with Environment Canada. I have people from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, I have a couple of them working for me. I've been in touch with many other departments within the federal ministry. This has been on the radar of things like Indian and Northern Affairs Canada. I file 2 reports a year with them. They've seen this coming for years.
So the federal government knew all about this then, as you understand?
At the level I work with, for sure. Like, I don't know what happens within the federal government. All I'm saying is that everyone from the Canadian Revenue Agency down to National Research Council and DFO and Environment Canada, all these people, they've all known about this.
And now they said the Environment Canada is saying it's investigating you.
Well, yeah, they came to meet me here in Masset, and I went to see them in Vancouver. You know, we're pretty friendly, and I told them, I promised them that they'll get a report from this as soon as I have a report to give.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there and continue to seek out all the answers on this. Mr. Disney, thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
John Disney is the president of the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation and the economic development officer for the Old Masset Village Council on Haida Gwaii. And so far, our requests for interviews with representatives from the federal departments of the Environment and Fisheries and Oceans have been turned down. But an official from DFO did say that although none of its employees were involved in the distribution of the iron sulfate, they have since been monitoring the project. We would also like to have your thoughts on this story tomorrow on As It Happens. Talkback can be reached toll-free, 1-866-481-5718. You can email us, aih@cbc.ca. We all make mistakes when we're 12 years old. Mistakes that are usually quickly forgiven and forgotten. But Amanda Todd's mistake was not forgotten. In the video the teenager made before she killed herself, she said that when she was in grade 7, she flashed her breasts to someone online, and that person later tried to blackmail her with the images. Now the hacker group Anonymous says that it knows who that person is. Yesterday, the group released a video naming a 30-year-old man in New Westminster, British Columbia. Here's part of Anonymous's online message.
Dear citizens of our nation, we have brought this announcement forwards solely for the purpose of releasing Amanda Todd's Punisher's identity. We are Anonymous. We are Legion. We do not forget. We do not forgive.
Part of a video message from the hacker group Anonymous. We're not naming the man named by the group, since none of those allegations have been proven. The RCMP say they are aware of the video and they may follow up on it. Well, the police also received information about images of Amanda Todd last year. The website cybertip.ca passed on the information. Signe Arneson is the director of that child protection charity. We reached her in Winnipeg.
Ms. Arneson, when you first heard about Amanda Todd, what did you make of that story?
Well, I think it's devastating. I think that this is every parent's worst nightmare, having your child feel like there's no other alternative but to end your life. I think it's about time that we have a good discussion about what's going on with youth and their vulnerabilities on the internet and how these types of things, I think, are happening on a more regular basis than we care to know.
After you saw that and read about Amanda Todd, you looked into your own files, and what did you discover?
Well, we had received a report on this particular case back in November of 2011, and we would have looked into the concerns from the reporting person, and we worked with child exploitation units right across the country, so that information was in fact forwarded to law enforcement in BC to determine what next steps they might take.
Did the police act on it when you passed the information on to them?
You know, we're not privy to what happens from an investigation standpoint. I know they did look into it, but I do not have any of the details surrounding the case itself.
For anyone who has watched that video, and it's very painful to do so, but the story she tells through the cards, the flashcards she holds up, the detail what happened to her, It seems that the emphasis has been, reporting has been on the bullying by other students. But there is this extraordinary story of this man who went after her. Can you describe that and what you make of it?
Well, you know, I do think there's an element in this that has been missed. I mean, she was 12 years old, and it appears that it was an adult on the other side of the computer. And it's
12 years old, sorry, when the story began.
The time when she lifted up her top and exposed her breasts and shared that image online, she was told she was beautiful, and she was vulnerable. And there are plenty of kids out there at the age of 12 that would have done the same thing. So I certainly think our level of empathy for what happens with kids and the decisions that they make needs to go up exponentially. You know, but you've got this individual on the other side of the computer that is likely an adult trying to extort and exploit this child. And essentially, this is the individual who started the whole journey for Amanda Todd in terms of sharing this information and getting it out to peers. And then that resulted sort of in the secondary trauma of being relentlessly bullied at the school she ended up attending. But at the front end of this, you have an individual who is essentially breaking the law and going after a 12-year-old.
Amanda says herself in those flashcards, she says that this began with one mistake, which was a 12-year-old girl showing her breasts on a webcam, and she believes everything followed from there. Do children know the consequences of going on webcams? And she said she wanted to make friends when she did that.
Well, I think what this individual did is hitting on everything that's developmentally concerning about having teens with sort of free rein online, and that's a very difficult thing to manage and control. We've essentially opened up the wild, wild west, and child development and them being sexually curious, which is a very natural thing to be at that age, but combined with the power of the internet is essentially a loaded gun, and it can turn very dark for kids very quickly, and it's something that they're not capable of managing. I know plenty of adults who can't properly manage their online relationships and the information that they put out there, and I don't think we should be running to judgment surrounding a 12-year-old and how she was essentially manipulated and extorted into this type of situation. There is absolutely no way we can expect youth and children to compete with adults.
And this man, he kept pursuing her. He put information on Facebook. He said he knew her family, he knew her friends, he knew where she lived. She moved to another school. He knew that. He followed her from place to place, and at one point even had a picture of her breasts as his Facebook image.
Mm-hmm.
So he just intimidated her for years.
Yes, it was relentless. And in terms of the grooming process and what happens to kids, the persistence is there, the threats are there. Unfortunately, there are enough people out there that engage in this kind of conduct. And, you know, this individual, it wouldn't surprise me a drop if they were able to identify who this was, that in fact he's likely doing this to other teens. They typically don't. It's not enough to do it to one. So, you know, kids are vulnerable, and I think we have to certainly give them the wiggle room to be able to come forward and acknowledge when they've made a mistake and not take a position of judgment, but try and support them through the poor decision that they've made. And we've got to be talking to kids on a regular basis about exploring your sexuality and trying to figure things out as a natural part of your development. You just don't want to be combining that with the internet.
This hacker group known as Anonymous has now said that they have found this person who was hounding Amanda, and they will expose him with address, with details about where he lives. What do you make of that?
I mean, people that work in the space have heard of Anonymous before. I certainly don't condone vigilante activity because in some ways you can be interfering with an investigation that may already be ensuing from a police perspective. If they have, in fact, identified this individual, then I hope that law enforcement are able to intervene and catch this person.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you for your insights, Ms. Arneson.
Okay, thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Signe Arneson is the director of cybertip.ca. That is a website dedicated to fighting child exploitation. She was in Winnipeg. In most novels, the birth of a child, of either sex, is a good thing. It's a fortuitous thing, a source of unadulterated joy for the characters. But in Shauna Singh Baldwin's new novel, The Selector of Souls, the birth of a child is far more complicated than that, especially if that child is a girl. In that case, the child often causes sorrow and disappointment and leads people to take drastic measures to cope with that sorrow and disappointment. The novel is set in India, where millions of girls go missing every year, and millions of female fetuses are aborted before they're even born. Those grim statistics are the starting point for Ms. Baldwin's book, which also deals with institutionalized sexism and misogyny, and in particular the struggles of two women, one a member of the lower caste, the other of a higher caste. Shauna Singh Baldwin joined Carol in our Toronto studio to talk about The Selector of Souls.
Shauna Singh Baldwin, welcome to the As It Happens studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to begin not just at the end, but actually beyond the end of the book, because in your acknowledgments, you actually say what motivated you, what inspired you to write the book, which is you describe the numbers of girls who are simply missing in India. Just how many baby girls are we talking about here?
We're talking about 3 million missing girls in the 90s. And then another 4 million missing girls in the year 2001 to 2008. And these are UNFPA India's figures. And then worldwide, we're talking about 160 million missing girls from the 1970s to the present. So these are estimates. We have no way of really judging them, but
What does it mean to be missing? What do these numbers refer to then?
These numbers refer to sex selection and gendercide. Those are almost interchangeable terms. Gendercide includes, gendercide being selection for boys as well as for girls. But in this case, we're talking about sex selection against girls, winnowing girls from the population. So I remember when I first encountered this problem, I said, you know, how can this be? Oh, well, it's because of son preference. But it's really not son preference anymore. It's daughter aversion.
And these are girls who were aborted as fetuses, and also girls who were killed or even starved in their
Yes, the discrimination is on a spectrum that goes from gender selection through IVF and then ultrasound and then female infanticide and then further on through a woman's life. But discrimination in so many different forms is responsible for missing girl children. So it's girls from the age of, birth all the way to 5 and 6 year olds. They're in a very dangerous situation. And it's not just happening in India. It's happening throughout Asia and also in our country here. And it is a part of a way of looking at girls. And I wanted to examine that. But that really was an exploration, a question mark that I just wanted to explore. How does this happen? How can women discriminate against girls?
And why is it tolerated?
Well, why is it tolerated? Because of economics. But that is pretty obvious as to why, you know, why is it tolerated? Because it's profitable to do so. But when you come down to how somebody can actually kill a child or deny themselves the privilege of having a girl or look upon a girl as a liability and a boy as an asset, that to me was more interesting because the economics of it are very plain and they are expounded daily. Well, you know, you need to have a dowry for a woman. Well, you know, a woman costs money and to raise and there's no point in educating a young woman because, well, she's going to go to another family and you're not going to have the benefit of her in your old age, whereas a son will stay. And there's also the taboo against living with or taking from a daughter that's very strong in South Asian culture.
In fact, there's one character in your novel who says, "If father says that if you show love, if you love a daughter, you're simply watering another man's garden."
That's right, and that is the saying, the proverb, in fact, that I just merely translated into English.
Why did you decide to create a work of fiction around this issue?
Well, because I think it's not enough to describe the problem. There are also very creative ways in which we can solve these problems, and I wanted to show creative women creatively solving these problems, you know. And it's one thing to set up the problems, ain't it awful, you know? But we can do something about these practices. And A, there has to be realization. And so one of the women in the novel actually comes to a different understanding of what femininity means in the world and why it's necessary, you know? And then the other woman realizes that it's not enough to escape to the Himalayas and just go away from the problem. She has to actually deal with it. And so she comes out of apathy, really, and tries to do something about it. But these are the solutions that one can offer, but you can only offer them and model them for people in a novel format. Because if you just say, well, these are the solutions, well, okay, that's nice, you know, but let's show somebody actually doing this.
And who you show, you mentioned the two women in this novel, The Selectors of Souls. It's centered around the lives of two women from vastly different worlds, from different class, different caste, which is very important in India for speaking specifically of that, different age, different experiences. Their lives are thrown together during their individual efforts to help the lives of girls and women.
That's right.
I want to talk about Damini first, if you can just describe her for us.
When the novel opens, she's about 50 years old, and she's working in Delhi. And she's been in relative comfort for 30 years, looking after an old lady. She's been a pair of ears for this old lady. And the old lady is very well off, and yet she is subject to elder abuse, and eventually Damini loses her job, and all of a sudden she's thrown out into the world, and she's a widow, and so she has no place to go, so she breaks a taboo, and she goes and she lives with her daughter, and that starts a series of events that just sets her off on a whole different life, and she has to reevaluate everything she ever knew just from breaking this taboo.
And when Damini goes to live with her daughter and her son-in-law and her grandchildren, she looks for some role. She feels she needs to make herself useful. And she sees that her daughter Leela is desperate because she's just given birth to a girl. Mm-hmm. And Damini does something quite desperate. And I think because it's in the first few pages that this happens, I'll tease it out of you if you want to describe how much of what she decides she must do. But she's confronted with, you're shaking your head, no, you're not going to.
No, I'm not going to tell you. But I do think that the important thing is that she commits a crime to maintain the status quo. She tries so hard to keep everything just the way it is. And so many women do that. But Damini's a past master at trying to keep everything just right for the men. And that's where she has been all her life, you know. She's been trying to keep things perfect for everybody. And so she does something that then haunts the rest of her story. And nobody has seen her do it. Nobody knows that this has happened. The only person who knows it is Damini. But she does know it, and that knowing changes everything for her as she goes forward.
You're listening to As It Happens, and Shauna Singh Baldwin is here in the studio with me, and we're talking about her latest novel, The Selector of Souls. The other main character is Anupam. Anu, also, it's short. She's shortened as her nickname, I suppose.
Yes.
She has all the advantages that Damini could only have dreamed of. Mm-hmm. But her life is perhaps even more difficult. Tell us a bit about Anu.
Yeah. Anu's backstory is interesting in that she tries very hard to please and marries in an arranged marriage and soon finds herself involved in a very abusive marriage. And she doesn't even realize it as she goes along, but she never wanted children and then gets persuaded into at least getting married. And then once she gets married, at least having one child. And pretty soon when she has one little girl, well, she's hostage because that little girl is so important. And yet that little girl is a child of rape. And so it's very hard for her to accept that little girl as well. So she, at a certain point, when she feels that the child is safe, for a short period of time, she has a little window of opportunity, and she takes it, and she leaves. And when she leaves, there aren't a lot of support systems for her in the 1990s. There are no safe houses to which you can go in India at that time for a long period of time. And so she decides to go back to her convent school and become a nun. And so she becomes a novice, and she takes the initial vows. But you have 5 years in which to decide if you're going to be a full nun. And this is the period in which she meets Damini, and their lives cross.
These two women, their lives come together over this this as they try to do what they think is right. But that what's so clear about both of them is that no matter what caste, what station of life, the women, all the women in your novel, including the old woman that that Damini was taking care of, Memsab, who is very wealthy, very well positioned, mm-hmm. They're all powerless. They have no control over their lives unless they make desperate acts of sacrifice.
Well, they live lives that are circumscribed, but within that, they certainly, I think, assert their own power, and to the extent that they can. I mean, they are very assertive. I mean, you see, for instance, Mem Sahib putting Damini down because she can. So where she can assert her power, she does. Unfortunately, the only place she can is over another woman. And this, of course, permeates the novel. Where women can show power, it turns out that they have the opportunity to put other women down. Now, the question is, do they take it or do they support other women? And, you know, the novel is so much of a meditation for me on creation and destruction. We make the decision at every moment as to whether we're going to move in the direction of creativity or we're going to move in the direction of destruction. And these women are no different.
Which is what the selector of souls tells you. And yet we are talking about India, and India is fashions itself as a very contemporary democracy. Women have rights by law. They have universal suffrage. India had a female prime minister long before any other country did, or most countries did. So what is it that that tolerates this? I mean, not just among at Damini's level, you mm-hmm. know, but at the highest levels of the society.
I think that individuality has not yet come for women, in most places. Women can do many things economically, but I think their lives are still very circumscribed. Now, there are so many women whose lives are not circumscribed. I'm not writing about them, though, right? So I'm writing about people who are in this globalization phase, and because everything has to be evaluated based on profit motive. Suddenly, the sweetness is going out of life. The ideas of compassion and connectivity and all of these things that are feminine values, creativity, all of these are just sort of dropped by the wayside because the country is moving so fast in the direction of benefit, munafa is what it's called, and, you know, profit, that that all of the feminine values are going away. You can also say that it was hyper-masculinity that was coming into vogue in the 90s. And this is all coming in as a part of religion as well. And it is circumscribing women's lives a lot more than before.
Yes, so you think in a modern India gives women fewer privileges than an ancient India?
In some ways, because the woman is expected to be profitable or else, you know, so either she's working at home and bringing in income. If she's not working, then she's not profitable. And what shall we do with her? So the trend towards sex selection is actually higher in the 90s and the 2000s because each child is being viewed as a product rather than a person.
This is As It Happens, and I am in the studio with Shauna Singh Baldwin, and we're talking about her latest novel, The Selector of Souls. Go back to Damini, who is trying to help support her family, and in doing so, she takes a job escorting women to an ultrasound clinic.
Yes.
How common are these clinics in rural
very,
India?
Oh, they're very popular, very overt. GE Medical Systems was the name of the company at the time in Milwaukee that is now GE Healthcare, and they formed an alliance with a company in India called Wipro. And Wipro began to miniaturize some of these ultrasound machines, so they were perhaps the size of a desktop computer at one stage, and then they came down further and further. And now they're very easy to use, and they can be carried around by, quote, doctors in little vans to rural areas as well as to the cities. But at the time that I'm writing about, in the 90s, you still had to go to an ultrasound clinic. And they would advertise on the outside of these clinics, you know, pay this much now or pay the girl's dowry later. That's what they were saying. And so the ultrasound came in as a piece of technology that could really give people the information as to whether it was a girl or a boy. And late-term abortions were performed to rid people of girls. But the ultrasound is passé now. You have IVF, you have PGD, the prenatal gender determination. you have many other ways in which this can be done. And before ultrasound, there was amniocentesis. So the technology is really not the point so much as the desire to what's called drop a girl child.
But Dominique, who is already tortured by the choices she made in relation to girl babies, why do you think she, why do you have her, why does she agree to become an agent of the elimination of girl babies?
Because she doesn't want to do what she did before. Again, she wants to help women make choices themselves. So in her mind, she is actually helping women to make choices. The problem is that she's helping to get rid of girl babies. And not all choices that women make are right necessarily because they are women who are making the choices, you see. I'm not saying that.
That's
right.
No, you are. And it's interesting with this, because she has this debate with Anu. And this is the point when Damini and Anu cross over, because yes. Anu is now a novice
nun,
and she's
very pro-life. Yes.
And she's part of the Catholic Church.
She's part of the Catholic Church.
And mm-hmm. there is now she has Damini working for her, and realizes Damini is counseling women on getting abortions.
That's
right. So the two of them realize they both are trying to help women. But neither of them really is, because, of course, Anu is going by the Catholic Church tenets that there should be no yes. family planning at all. And mm-hmm. so it's just a schmozzle at this point.
Yes, there is. And I think that one of the things that both of them have to realize is that they have to transcend this debate. And for me, I began to realize that I'm pretty conflicted about this too, just like most women are. You know, we're not anxious to get rid of our own progeny. It's not something that that women would like to do. I mean, it's an awful decision if a woman has to do that. But at the same time, the choice has to be available, because it is your own body. Now, I'm someone who has decided not to have children. But people don't realize that that's a valid choice too. So whether you don't have children or whether you do have children, society says, you know, you're a bad person either way. So or enters into your decision in some fashion. So I just wanted to have them understand that this is not the only debate that there is between pro-life and pro-choice. We somehow have to transcend this debate and go forward with a whole different idea of providing reproductive services to women.
But also understanding the returning to some appreciation of the beauty of having girls.
Yes, and the beauty of femininity and the sweetness of girls and the innocence of children. You know, these are the things that we need to celebrate and enjoy as parents, as opposed to how is this child going to help me 20 years down the road when I'm an old person?
There's an astonishing scene that you have here that demonstrates exactly what you're saying, and that's takes place in the clinic that Sister Anu is running. And it's there's an upper caste woman named Kiran, and she attempts to switch her baby girl for that of a lower caste woman whose name is Goldina, and that woman has a baby boy, Moses. I wonder if you could read a bit of that for us.
Thank you, I will. Sister Anu is making her second cup of tea when she hears shrieking. She turns off the burner and hastens into the men's ward. And there's Kiran, sitting up in bed, twisting away from Goldina. A swaddled infant is in Kiran's arms. Hut! Hut, Jarjuri! She shouts. Damini is trying to restrain Goldina. You stole Moses! Screams Goldina. She whirls to face Damini as if demon-possessed. You gave Moses to her. That's my son. Sister Anu takes a huge breath and shouts at all of them to stop. Damini and Goldina turn. Goldina's face is ugly with hurt and rage. "Get the sweeper woman out of here," says Kiran to Sister Anu in English, looking down her nose with half-closed eyes. Sister Anu unwraps the infant Goldina has laid on the red blanketed bed beside Kiran's. It's the girl. Sister Anu gives the girl to Damini and reaches for the baby in Kiran's arms. Kiran's expression turns unreadable. "Mrs. Singh, please would you return Goldina's baby?" Kiran says in English, "You get this filthy woman out of my room." Thankfully, Goldina doesn't understand the words, but she can't miss the tone. Sister Anu's hands fall to her sides. She can't wrest a baby out of Kiran's arms. "I told you I shouldn't come here. I told you," Goldina screams at Damini in Hindi. "It's a mistake, Goldina," Sister Anu says. "Don't worry, it's easily corrected." Can Damini be the culprit? No. The kind old woman isn't capable of such a deed. She wouldn't let Sister Anu down. Mrs. Amanjit Singh is just taking advantage. She turns back to Goldina. "Go with Damini. She'll help you back to your bed." Goldina doesn't budge. Sister Anu summons all her gentleness and turns back to Kiran. She sits down on the next bed so their eyes are level. "Mrs. Singh, you and your husband have done so much for this clinic. Don't you think it would hurt its reputation in the community if a baby was switched?" She persuades, cajoles, coaxes. Suddenly, Kiran is waving a white envelope before her eyes and cooing, "A small donation for an auspicious day." "It's outrageous." Kiran obviously came prepared in case a bribe was needed. She probably intended her envelope for Dr. Gupta. Customary procedure, just as it was for Vikas. Goldina knows what's in the envelope. So does Damini. Some things need no translation. Yet Kiran doesn't care if they see her offer a bribe. Who will believe Goldina or Damini if they tell? Sister Anu musters the remnants of her compassion and looks Kiran in the eye. "Kiranji, when a mother feels compelled to give up her child, how can this day be called auspicious?"
That's Shana Singh Baldwin reading from The Selector of Souls. Have you ever heard of anything like that happening?
Of course.
And the bribe would have been paid?
Yes.
And how many women would have accepted that? Goldina doesn't. She's insisting that she's going to
Right.
keep Moses.
Goldina's different. Goldina's not like a lot of women. But, you know, it's very hard to say how many women would accept a bribe. I don't know. You know, these are quiet things that are done very, very under the table, as they say. But, you know, there's a price that I was told for a baby boy, 50,000 rupees. And this is a street price for a child, you know.
You've said something, some of it already, about what has to change and attitudes toward them. But how much has to change? I mean, obviously, I mean, there are laws in place. They're obviously ineffectual.
Laws, yes.
So what has to change in order to improve, protect, just to appreciate, so that we don't see millions of girls disappear?
Well, I think that the solutions that my female characters find in this book are some of the solutions that we can use. Of course, there are organizations that we can found in order to make sure that abandoned girls are looked after. There's one over here called girlkind.org, and that's trying to educate people about the fact that we should not consider girls to be the enemy as such. So that's within Canada itself, within the South Asian community. And there are other solutions that Damini and Anu find about coming together as women who are both pro-life and pro-choice and moving forward together to say that, for example, a woman can give her name to a child. If a man says, "You know, I'm not giving my name to this child. I don't know where it came from. Sorry, you can't be part of our family." the woman's family name can be given to a child. Now, this has happened very successfully, for instance, in South Korea. They've actually stemmed the tide. And most people believe that it is because they have allowed women to give their last name to a child so that a man cannot withhold his name. There are other things that can be done, and the women model them through their actions, setting up adoption centers, actually trying to find parents who wish to be parents as opposed to simply have a child as an asset or a liability. So there's a certain number of things that the women in this book do to try to address your question.
You have hope, don't you, that this can
change? Of course, of course. Sister Anu belongs to the order of everlasting hope.
Shauna Singh Baldwin, it's great to meet you, and thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Carol is speaking with author Shauna Singh Baldwin. Her latest novel, The Selector of Souls, is published by Knopf, Canada. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius Satellite 137 following The World at 6.
You can also listen to the whole show on the web. Just go to cbc.ca/AIH and follow the links to our online archive. Thanks for listening. I'm Carol Off.
And I'm Jeff Douglas.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.